And thanks to my sponsor, Triple Gem Centre. Now, this evening's Dhamma talk, again, every talk which you give in the evening is about your normal life, about how to have less problems and suffering, to live more peacefully, more successfully, more happily. And today is all about worry and anxiety and fear and... I don't know why people are so worried in life, because look, it's you never know what's going to happen next, and every time you worry, it's always about things which most of the time never even happen. I don't know what you're worried about today, but I remember that the first lesson I ever got on the stupidity of worry and anxiety was when I was still a little boy. I must have been about 8 or 9 years of age, and I had a dentist appointment the following day, and I did not like going to dentists. I hated going to dentists. And when my mummy told me, tomorrow, darling, you've got to go to dentist, I said, I don't want to go. She said, you have to go. No, I'm not going. Yes, you will go. I don't want to go. And he said, you must. And I was very upset. And that night, I didn't sleep well. I had all these nightmares of dentists with all this torture equipment in your mouth. And when I woke up in the morning, I still thought maybe I could get out of going to the dentist. So I asked my mummy again, Mummy, I don't want to go to dentist. She said, you have to go to dentist. And I said, I used my last trick. I said, Mummy, you don't love me. I said, I do love you, darling. Why are you sending me to dentist? You don't love me. But she ended up dragging me to the dentist. And I really hated it. I was so upset. And then when I got to the dentist, I found out that my appointment was cancelled. And all that worry and anxiety for nothing. It never happened. And isn't that our life? All of the anxiety, the fear and worry we have, 99% of it never happens. So whatever you're afraid of, always remember this. Whatever you're afraid of will never happen. It will either never happen at all, or something much worse will happen. But what you're afraid of doesn't happen at all. So a lot of times, as a meditator, as a monk who knows the nature of the mind, you wonder, why do people worry? Why are they anxious? And number one, it's because you like worrying. You're addicted to worrying. Which is why people love watching these soap operas, where you're worried about what's going to happen next week. And you love the excitement. And so, sometimes people love anxiety so much they go to these theme parks where they have death drops. You're strapped into this cubicle and you fall down at enormous speed, and fortunately you stop at the last minute and you scare yourself stupid. What do you do that for? Because you love anxiety. And so when you understand that, yeah, we're addicted to this, no wonder that sometimes you go too far and your anxiety doesn't become another entertainment but becomes a big problem. And this is where the Dhamma can kick in. So when you're anxious, first type of anxiety, we always think that something terrible is going to happen. And when you think that something terrible is going to happen, it usually does happen. You make it happen. Because fear is magnetic. It draws what you're afraid of to you. When I was a kid, the last years when I was watching TV, it was over 36 years ago, and there was a TV show I will never forget. It was called Kung Fu. Anyone old enough to remember that movie? Or that TV series? I think David Carradine. He was this Chinese migrant to the United States
who had learned kung fu in a monastery in China, and he was going around, you know, beating up all the cowboys with his bare hands. Very exciting. But every now and again he'd say something Buddhist, which is why I tuned in. But on this particular episode, I'll never forget this episode, because it said a lot about anxiety. In this particular episode, he was still a young novice in this monastery in China. And he had a little name, it was called Grasshopper. Remember that, Grasshopper? And so little Grasshopper was taken into this dark room by his master. His old master was blind, but very, very wise. And he took him into this very dark, spooky room. And then the master asked Grasshopper, "What can you see in this room?" And Grasshopper said, "I see a swimming pool. There is a pool in here with water in it." "Don't go close," said the master, "because that's not water, that's acid. Concentrated, strong, flesh-eating acid. But just go a little bit close to the edge and tell me what you see in the bottom of the pool of acid." And he went close to the edge, and in the bottom, and I could see this on the TV screen, he said, "I see bones, master. Human bones. Many of them in the bottom of the pool." "Yes," said the master. "Those are the bones of little novices like you in the past who fell in. What else do you see?" He said, "I see a plank. I see a plank of wood stretching from this side to the far side." "Yes," said the master. "In 7 days' time, you will be tested. You will have to walk over that pool of acid on that narrow plank, and if you fall in, your bones will join the ones already there." And poor little Grasshopper was quite scared, and even me sitting in my lounge room in London, I was scared too. And then they took him out, both came out from that room, and out in the temple courtyard there was another plank of wood, exactly the same size but on two bricks. And the master said, "For 7 days you don't have to do any chanting, no services, no meditation. All you have to do is practice balancing, because in 7 days' time you'll be tested on the real plank over the pool of concentrated burning acid." So for 7 days little Grasshopper practiced, and it wasn't that hard to do, to balance, and after a few days he could actually run along the plank. Sometimes he could do it blind like his master. It was easy to do. But after 7 days he had the real test. They took him in to the dark room, and the master put him on the end of the plank. And he saw little Grasshopper turn round to his master, and you could see from the expression on his face, little Grasshopper was saying, "Don't make me do it. Please, don't make me do it." "Walk," shouted the master. So poor little Grasshopper had to begin balancing on this plank across the pool of concentrated acid, knowing one false step and he'll be burned to death with an agonizing, cruel end to his young life. And as he started walking, he realized a plank the same width and length on the temple courtyard is much wider than the real thing over acid. He could hardly keep his balance, and as he got towards the middle, you could see his legs start to shake. As he reached the middle, he started to sway as he was losing his balance. And as he took another step, it looked like he was going to fall in. And then we had the commercial break. Oh, I hated those advertisements. You're wound up and you had to wait for 4 or 5 minutes before you found out what really happened. But soon the commercials were over. And we were back in that scary room, just usually like a few frames back from when it ended. So you could start by seeing little Grasshopper. His legs started to wobble. And then he started to sway. And then it looked like he was going to fall in. And he did fall in. Little Grasshopper fell into the acid. And he splashed around. And his compassionate master started laughing. And the little Grasshopper splashed around. It wasn't burning. What's going on? And the master said, "Don't worry, Grasshopper. It's not acid. It's only water. And we threw those bones in the bottom as special effects." And then he said to Grasshopper, "Why did you fall in?" "Fear pushed you in, little Grasshopper. Only fear. Because if I'd have told you that was water, you'd have been able to run across that plank. But once you thought it was acid, once you had fear, fear pushed you in, little Grasshopper. Just fear made you fall." When I saw that, I realized what a wonderful example of the psychology of fear. What you fear is going to happen, you make happen. Which is why anxiety is the most stupid of emotions. Simply because what you're anxious of happening, you usually make happen because of your fear. So if you want to avoid all those terrible things happening to you, don't be afraid. And then they're far less likely to happen. I know this because very often I've been in very, very scary places. I remember being in jungles where there were not man-eating tigers, but monk-eating tigers. Where there were snakes, really bad snakes, who would attack you. I was told when I first went to Thailand that there were 100 species of snake. 99 of those species were venomous. If they bit you, you were dead. And the other one would strangle you to death. They were all very, very dangerous. But you know, with snakes, if you're afraid, then they get afraid. And then they overreact, and you overreact, and that's when they bite you. Snakes are okay, they don't mind human beings. Human beings don't mind snakes, it's fear which kills you. That's why one of my favorite monks, he doesn't have any anxiety or fear. Because we know that, because once in the jungles of Thailand, he was meditating with a few other monks. And they heard a sound of a jungle creature coming towards them. So they opened their eyes. And the creature was a snake, a cobra, a king cobra. And in that part of Thailand, there was a slang term for the king cobra. It was called the one-step snake. The reason it was called a one-step snake, because once it bit you, that's all you had left of your life. One step, and then you were dead. That was a very dangerous snake. So when the one-step snake, the king cobra, came towards this monk, he came right up to him, lifted up its head, opened its hood, right in front of his nose. What would you do? Don't think of running. Those snakes can go much faster than you. That was actually a scary thing when I saw how fast snakes could run and saw them even swimming as well. I thought, there's no escape. So this monk was faced with this venomous snake right in front of his nose. Now this was a monk with no anxiety, with no fear. So what he did, he raised his hand and he patted Mr. Snake on the head. Thank you, Mr. Snake, for coming to visit me. It's a true story. All the other monks saw this. And did the monk bite? So did the snake bite that monk? Of course not. Snakes love having their head patted. Oh, it's such rare to get my head patted. The snake loved every minute of that. And after having its head patted long enough, the cobra pulled in its hood, put its head down, and went to visit one of the other monks. And the other monk said, I'm not going to do that, go back to him. But of course, if you're kind, the snake will never bite you. Why are you anxious? If you're anxious, then it bites you, because it knows you're afraid, and you feel fear, it feels fear, and then both of you sort of overreact. My snake story, I didn't pat a snake, but something very similar. Once in Thailand, I'd been meditating all night, not having any sleep, while I meditated until dawn. So number one, my mindfulness was not as strong as it should have been. Number two, I went out to urinate in the forest, and the light was just the light of dawn, so it wasn't so clear. And as I squatted down, Asian style, not Western style, I was well trained. You squat down, and I urinated in the forest. I thought I was urinating on a stick. Until the stick started to move. And I realized at that time, the most sensitive part of a male anatomy was only 2 inches away from this snake's mouth, and I just peed on it. But was I anxious? No, I wasn't afraid. And did the snake get afraid? No, the snake loved every minute of it, because the snake knew it was being blessed with holy water. You can't get more holy than that. But if I was afraid and anxious, then I might have got bitten, as I might have reacted. So it's anxiety is the problem. It actually makes bad things happen. And why do you get anxious anyway? Because a lot of anxiety and fear is actually looking in the future and thinking of all the bad things which will happen. You know that simile of the two bad bricks in the wall, which I gave a few days ago? That's when we look in a wall and all we see is the two mistakes. We can't see anything else. Fear is looking at the future and just seeing the two bad things which might go wrong. And we don't see the 998 things which could go right. And you know, in the future, the chance of things going right are usually much, much more likely than things going wrong. Which is why why on earth are people afraid of flying in aircraft? I know a lady said to me in the interviews just a day or two ago that she was wanted to visit her daughters over in Europe and the United States, but she was afraid of flying. You know, the aircraft going up and down. Now, if you're afraid of the aircraft going up and down, do not fly Qantas, because Qantas is a kangaroo. And kangaroos know, they go up and down, up and down, up and down. I fly a lot. Now, I always sort of seem to get in an aircraft going here and coming there. And I'm not afraid. I know that sometimes, that you know, there are terrorists around and they try and blow up aircraft. And people once asked me, aren't you afraid? That, you know, you may be up in an aircraft at 30,000 feet and somebody may have these explosive underpants or shoes and blow the plane up at 30,000 feet. And I told people, I am not afraid of dying at 30,000 feet.
I've always got a very positive mind. So I told him the three benefits of dying in an aircraft explosion at 30,000 feet. So remember these three benefits when you fly, and then you won't get afraid. The first benefit of dying at 30,000 feet is you have an instant on-the-spot cremation. Your family doesn't have to arrange it with a temple. It's all done on the spot, very efficient, very quick. If you've ever organized a funeral service for your family members, you know how much trouble it takes. So there, it's all done. Very, very efficient. Number two. That's the first one. It's instant cremation. No trouble at all. Number two. How expensive are funeral services here in KL? How much do you have to pay these monks and family? They always come for lunch and for dinner and everything else, breakfast. Goodness gracious, it costs you a fortune. If you die at 30,000 feet, not only doesn't it cost you a penny, but you also get money back from the airline. You actually make money out of somebody's death. That's the second benefit, the financial benefit. And the last benefit is the best of all. If you happen to die at 30,000 feet in aircraft explosion, you are so close to heaven, it's easier to go the rest of the way. So there are three benefits. So why are you afraid of flying? It'd be wonderful, straight to heaven, you're almost there. So the point is there that when you actually look at what really is likely to happen, rather than the worst case scenario, the worst case scenario very rarely happens. What really happens is something much better than that. So all the things you're afraid of in life, all the things you're anxious of, you find you're anxious about mirages, about things which never happen. And you wonder, why am I doing that? You're actually totally irrational. So if you want to overcome fear, look at the future, and look at the future with a positive attitude. Not what might go wrong, but think of what might go right. And when you start thinking of what might go right, you're actually, because of that positive attitude, you're actually giving the right things more opportunity to actually be generated. By a positive attitude, you attract the successes. But when you're really negative, you attract the failures of life. Just like that story of Little Grasshopper. So if you think of all the things which might go right, they usually do go right, and you realize, what was the point of worrying anyway? And anyway, if it does go wrong, it means you just wasted all that wonderful time when you could have been watching the movie on the aircraft instead of worrying about being blown up. You're going to be blown up anyway, so you might as well enjoy the last couple of hours. What's the point of worrying about it? So as a monk, we trained ourselves not to worry. There was one occasion when I was in Thailand. And in that particular time, that's about 25 years ago, 30 years ago, there was all these old buses which they used to take people all over the northeast. They were so old and very poorly maintained that very often they'd actually burst into flames. And actually it was in the newspapers, a whole series of bus fires where many people were killed, incinerated, because they could not get out in time, in the newspaper. I don't know why it was that so many all in one sort of month, but I happened to be travelling on one of the buses. You were sitting like the front seat, as I said the other day, you know, to protect you from crashes, but they didn't realise you can't protect you from fires. And I was next to the window, and there was another monk sitting next to me, next to the aisle, and on the other side was a bus driver. And as we were driving along in the northeast, someone in the back shouted, "Fire! Fire! Fire!" And there was smoke coming from the back. And the bus driver slammed on the brakes. And as soon as it stopped, he jumped out the window. That's how scared they were. And everybody else, they pushed right past as they tried to get out. Even the monk sitting next to me, he was out like a shot. As for me, I just sat there. The reason was because I couldn't understand Thai. I didn't know what they were talking about. So I just sat there. There's a lot of benefits being stupid. And all the people went out, and I was just sitting there wondering what was going on, until there was only two people left in the bus, myself and another man. He looked in the back, it was just a cigarette. That's what it was. And he shouted out to everyone, "It doesn't matter, it's not a fire, it's just a cigarette, you can all come back in." And as everyone filed past me, they all bowed to me. "Oh, you're such a great monk. You must be an arahat. You've got no fear." Oh, it was one of the most wonderful moments of my monk life. I never told him it's because I was stupid. I didn't understand what was going on. But sometimes when you don't know what's going on, you don't worry, and sometimes it's very good. So that's why ignorance is bliss. Don't worry so much about what goes wrong, because that's what happens, you know. Sometimes you read the newspapers, you know, about the latest disease. Like, what was it, dengue fever? And is it Michael? S1H1, was it?
H1N1.
That's swine flu. So you read all the newspapers about swine flu. And what's the symptoms of swine flu? You feel fever? Do you feel a bit hot? That's what happens. People worry themselves sick. "I feel a bit hot today. Oh my goodness, it must be swine flu." And that worry and anxiety, that is what kills you. Now, psychologically, you know that if you really believe that you've got those symptoms, you can make those symptoms occur. I was a scientist before, and I loved psychology experiments. There was one experiment which was done in Bristol jail 100 years ago. It was done once, it was never done again. There was one poor man who'd been sentenced to death by hanging 100 years ago. He'd done some terrible crime, and he had the death sentence. The following morning he was to be hung. The night before, these two psychologists with the head of the prison came to see him. They lied. They said the law had been changed. He will die, but not by hanging. The following morning he would have his throat cut. He will die by throat cut. And they left this poor man to think of that all night. The following morning they came into his cell. The priest gave him his last prayers, and they put a blindfold over him and tied his hands behind his back and led him to the place of execution. However, they never told him that where they led him was the prison washroom. They sat him on a chair, they read out the sentence, and then one of the prison officers took one of the old razors, you know, the cutthroat razors, and drew the blade, the blunt end, across his throat, so he wasn't even scratched. But at the same time, one of the other psychologists turned on a tap so he could hear liquid gurgling out. The poor man wasn't even scratched, but he fell down and died. Because he believed he was being executed, that was enough to kill him. That was an experiment which was done, which shows just the power of our thoughts. If we think we're going to die, we do die. So you can imagine, if you think you're going to get H1N1, you do. Never underestimate the power of the mind and the power of fear to make things you're most afraid of actually happen. So that's the danger of anxiety. So look, you actually convince yourself, "I will not get H1N1, I will not get I haven't got H1N1. And the chances of you getting H1N1 are just so minuscule. How many people in Malaysia have got H1N1 so far? Anyone know? 10? 20? 30? Yeah, more or less. 100? 60? Let's say 60. Say 60. What's the population of Malaysia? 28 million. So 60 out of 28 million that's actually 1 in 500,000 roughly. So you've got 1 in 500,000 chance of getting H1N1. That's pretty low chance, isn't it? Why are you worried? There's more chance you might win the lottery. So people overreact with fear, and that's the biggest problem. So first of all, realize what the odds truly are. And number two, realize the stupidity and actually the fact that if you do worry about these things, you are almost making them happen. And number three, realize the future is uncertain anyway, so I don't know what's going to happen. You may get hit by a bus before you even get H1N1. So because of that, we learn how not to worry and have no anxiety. That's what I've done in my life as a monk. Whatever's going to happen to me, it doesn't matter what happens, both ways I win. If I die young, it means I don't have to go to nursing home. Phew. If I live long, then I can teach and help other people. Whichever way it works, I'm okay. It's just like when I first became a teacher. I thought, if I become a teacher, what's going to happen? If I give good talks, that's wonderful. I can make people happy and spread the Dharma. If I can't give any talks and people actually walk out the room when I start speaking, that's even better. I can become a hermit. You know, I always wanted to become a hermit. A nice quiet monk living alone in a cave somewhere. I often thought that, I fantasized, you know, that in Australia there's this big area of open land called the Nullarbor Plain. And underneath there's lots of caves with lots of water. And once I thought, I know, I'm just going to go and leave my monastery and become a hermit. Live in the caves, there's lots of water, I can get people to drop me food. And then I started fantasizing, what would it be like being like a hermit in the Nullarbor Plain in Australia? Sooner or later, somebody would find me. And they'd ask me, where are you from? How many brothers and sisters have you got? That was yesterday's talk. Soon somebody would find me. And then somebody would actually come from England and do a documentary on me. Because it's really weird, like the hermit of the Nullarbor. Somebody who gave up their Cambridge degree, gave up the world to live alone as a hermit. Isn't that the sort of program you would like to watch on TV? Yeah. So soon, you know, you'd become famous. The hermit of the Nullarbor. And then what would happen? You'd have all these coaches coming to see you. And they'd have these little shops selling tea and they're selling trinkets. They'd have these little dolls and little signs saying, I visited the hermit of the Nullarbor. And soon you'll have so many people coming to see you, you wouldn't have any peace at all. So I realized, look, you know, you can't escape from life. If you try, you can become more famous. So I realized, whatever happens, you know, if you make it good talks or bad talks, it's always win-win both ways. So I'm not afraid of anything. If you love my talks, great, I can make you happy. If you hate my talks, great, you can leave me alone. I have some peace at last. So when you have that sort of attitude, whatever happens to you, whichever way life turns, you can always be happy and peaceful. Then you have nothing to fear at all. When you realize there's no such thing as things going wrong, it's just life takes a different direction. In life, we have these great moments in our life. Sometimes they're very pleasurable, sometimes they're very painful. These are like forks in the road of life. And sometimes we think if it goes on that particular direction, it's going to be terrible. It's not. You make it work. So when I realize that whichever happens to me in life, it doesn't really matter. If I get sick, it's a wonderful thing being sick. Is that bad, being sick? How many people in this room have never been sick in your life? Put your hand up, please. Has anyone in this room never been sick? I can't see any hands up, so I can assume that each one of you has been sick. In fact, if you'd never been sick, ever, there'd be something very wrong with you. You'd be abnormal. It'd be one of these cases researchers will take into the lab and do tests on. So it would be something very wrong if you weren't sick from time to time. So why do you say that there's something wrong with me, I'm sick? You should always say there's something right with me, I'm sick again. It's wrong being healthy all the time, isn't it?
So the next time you go to the doctor with a flu or with any sickness, please go and tell them, "Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again." Number one, that takes off the guilt and the negativity about sickness, which is an important way of getting much better. So don't think that being sick means you made a big mistake. You haven't eaten enough rice. You haven't exercised. You've eaten too much greasy food. That's why you're getting sick. And so you feel guilty about it. Please don't feel guilty about being sick. It's all right being sick. I'm going to start a society, sick people's rights. Stop keeping putting us down and making us feel guilty. So if you get sick, why are you worried about being sick? Think of all the advantages of being sick. You don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. You can stay in bed late. All these amazing people come to visit you. You can eat whatever food you like sometimes when you're sick, because people are just very extra kind to you. So when you think that whatever happens to you in life, and the best part of being sick is that people can be very kind to you. And sometimes they're not kind at all. But when you're sick, they come out and see you, and they talk to you, and they give you special gifts. It's wonderful being sick, being the center of a compassionate group of people. And without you being sick, they wouldn't need to show their care and compassion. So your sickness is a great gift and opportunity for others to make good karma. So next time you're sick, tell your husband, your wife, about, "This is your opportunity to make good karma. I'm sick." So it can be really good fun. So that way I'm just putting the positive spin on being sick. So if you're healthy, if you're sick, what are you afraid of? Whatever route your life takes, you can always give it a positive spin, which is a brilliant understanding of life. It's so good that these days I tell people, when you're afraid of making choices, it doesn't matter whichever choice you make, whether you stay in your job or you leave to take another job, whether you marry this man or marry that man. Look, all you girls, you should know by now, all men are the same. It doesn't matter which one you choose. Same with the girls as well. Okay, I mean, you know, it's like buying a car. Sort of, you know, the colour might be different, but underneath the engine's all the same. You know that. So just, you know, choose one and have done with it. So that way, it doesn't really matter about choice. So these days, and I make choices very quickly, I don't worry about choice and get anxious, what should I do, which way should I go, because I know whichever way I go, it's always going to be good. I can always make it work. And that way you don't worry about anything in life. So sometimes, especially travelling, sometimes you miss your aircraft, the plane gets delayed. I remember when I was going to Indonesia once, I was flying Garuda, and the plane was delayed for 24 hours. That was a time when you had like the bird flu, and I figured out Garuda is the bird. Garuda must have got the flu. So I made a joke about it. But at Perth Airport, I saw these other people going to the counter and banging their fists on the counter, saying, "You've got to get this plane to me straight away. I've got an important appointment. Now, whatever, I've got to get there." And it doesn't matter how many times they bang their... I better stop doing that. But how many times they banged their fist, did the plane come any earlier? Of course not. They could bang their fist for 24 hours and the plane would just come when the plane wants to come. So it's a complete waste of time. And it didn't all go wrong. People managed to sort of get by. So whatever happens in life, you can always make it work. So I'm not worried about anything. Whatever happens, whatever goes wrong, it's okay. Now, sometimes people say to me, "Aren't you worried, Ajahn Brahm, if you make a mistake or do something wrong, especially the way you speak and tell all these jokes, you might offend someone, you may end up in jail." I told her, you know, to make sure you edit all these films that you're doing with me. I don't know what I've said, but sometimes it might offend somebody and go to one airport and get arrested at the airport. Well, I'm not afraid of going to jail. And sometimes I think, well, if I went to prison, it'd be wonderful. I wouldn't have to get up so early in the morning, because in prison you only get up at 6 o'clock, I'd be able to sleep in every morning. In prison you get 3 meals a day, I only get 2 meals, only 1 meal over in Perth. And I'd be able to, if ever I wanted to go on a retreat, what I need to do is punch one of the prison guards, I get solitary, 3 months retreat, no problem. So what am I worried for?
So I think you get the message here. A lot of worry is because we've got a negative attitude towards life. When we look in the future, we look at all the things which might go wrong instead of looking at all the things which might go right. When we look at all the things which might go right, number one, we don't have anxiety, and number two, we tend to attract more positive outcomes in our life. And that's really important, and understand that psychology. Whatever you think it's going to be, if you think the fearful things which might happen in life, you actually make them happen. If you think of the positive things which might happen in life, that's what you really generate. That's what comes about in your life. You've seen that happen in your life and other people's lives so many times. So be careful. But then again, we have this terrible thing which is chronic anxiety, or rather panic attacks which happen in people. And some of you will come over to a psychologist or psychiatrist or hopefully come to the temple, because we're really good. Buddhist monks, meditating monks are really good at overcoming all panic. Now, not only do we know all about panic and what actually happens, because when fear starts to come up, if you don't nip it in the bud, it makes huge fear out of small things. This is another one of my stories, being a monk in the jungle. You get great insights from nature. Because this was one evening, I was meditating in the jungle, and I was a good meditator. I was very peaceful, very quiet, relaxed. But then I heard the sound of a jungle animal coming towards me. Now again, I said in these jungles there were elephants, and elephants would kill monks. Now they weren't all Buddhist elephants, some were non-Buddhist. There were bears. The bears were especially, they were dangerous. You know, the snakes and the tigers and other stuff which would eat you up. And I was sitting there quietly, very mindful, when I heard a jungle animal coming towards me. So what I did, I stopped watching the breath, and I just assessed the sound. It was dark, so a waste of time opening my eyes. I wouldn't be able to see anything in the blackness. So I listened very mindfully. Now that sound, what could it be? And straight away I assessed it very carefully. It was only a small little animal, you know, maybe sort of a little civet cat or something. Or, no, a very small animal, maybe a rat, I don't know. But I just closed my eyes again. I stopped listening, went back to my breath, because it wasn't a big animal. But as it came closer, I could hear it more clearly. And I realized I got it wrong. That wasn't a small animal, that was a medium-sized one. Because you can actually tell by the way it crushed, you know, the twigs, and the way it sort of sounded on the leaves of the forest floor. Because you can't go silently on the forest floor. There's just too much stuff on there. You always make a noise. So I thought, man, that's actually a medium-sized animal. But you know, medium-sized animals would leave monks alone. It's only the big ones you should be dangerous, should be careful of. So I went back to my breath, breathing in quite sort of calmly. And as it came closer, I realized that I'd underestimated everything. Because it was making a huge sound. That was a big animal. A bear, tiger, or even an elephant. And that's when I got very afraid. Because it was making huge sound. I was mindful, I was careful, I was assessing it sort of, you know, as carefully as I possibly could. So I had no choice but to open my eyes and get out my flashlight. And I shone it, and I saw it. It was a tiny mouse, about that big. And I couldn't believe it. That made this huge sound, and it was only a tiny mouse. What was going on? It was fear, which had exaggerated the sound of a little mouse and made it into a monkey-eating tiger. And from that experience on, I realized how dangerous fear is. Fear exaggerates the danger so much that a small thing becomes this huge, terrible disaster about to happen. So you've got to be very careful, because fear, it just warps and changes the reality. And what is only a small thing becomes such a terror. You totally overreact. So now, I always remember, if there's any fear in my mind, I'm not seeing things clearly. I'm always exaggerating. So I always really check the fear, and I never trust it one bit. But if you really do have panic attacks, not just the wisdom teachings, which I'm teaching you here, but sometimes the meditation teachings, they really, really, really help. But very simple meditation. There was this classic tale, a classic story, had a very happy ending. There was this one disciple, her mother was Thai, her father was English, or Australian. And she was studying dentistry in Adelaide University. And she's got depression and anxiety disorder, which became so bad that even though she was seeing the psychologist in the university, her fear was so terrifying she couldn't even leave the house, she couldn't even get out of bed, so she was bedridden. And of course she could not go to any lectures, her academic career was just stagnating, you know, she was going to fail that year, and she had this terrible depression and paranoia which would not go away. She was very fortunate for two reasons. First of all, she had a boyfriend. One of these boyfriends, if you get one of these, never throw them away, because he would care for her, look after her, cook for her, wash her clothes. He was a great guy who really cared for her in the time she really needed it. And number two, she had a very good monk. Yep, me. So she called me, and it was her mother told her to call me, or rather her uncle told her to call me. She told me what was going on. She had this terrible panic attacks, and she could not bear even to get out of bed. So this is how I taught her. Over the telephone, I said, "What do those panic attacks feel like in your body?" I said, "Where do they manifest in your body?" And she said, "I don't know." And I said, "Give me a call in 2 days to give me the answer." So I gave her that job to do. That when she got afraid and had a panic attack, where in your body did that manifest a physical feeling? After 2 or 3 days she called and said, "Yeah, when I get panic attacks I can feel it in my chest." And I said, "Describe the feeling to me." She said, "I can't." I said, "Ring me up in 2 or 3 days and tell me." I gave her some work to do. And after 2 or 3 days, she came back to me and she described in detail what it really felt like. I said, "Marvelous. Now," I said, "when you start feeling those sensations, take your hand and start to massage those sensations. If you can't do it, get your boyfriend to do that for you. Give it some sort of, TLC, some metta, some love, and see if you can relax those feelings. And give me a call back in 2 or 3 days. And 2 or 3 days she called back and said, "Did you follow my instructions?" I said, "Yes." You know, I could feel those sensations arise, and I took my hand, I massaged them. I said, "What happened to those feelings?" I said, "They went away." "And what happened to your anxiety?" And she was silent. "That went away too." "Exactly," I said. "Now you know how to deal with your anxiety. If you try and deal with it on the emotional level, you will not be able to stop the anxiety. In fact, you will make it worse. But every emotion has a corresponding feeling somewhere in your physical body. Find out what that feeling is. Describe it to yourself, because that's the only way you can get to know it well. And when you've got to know it well, it's very easy to relax the body with massage, stroking, whatever, because if you give it some soft kindness, the physical tightness disappears. And once the physical tightness disappears, the corresponding mental emotion also vanishes." That worked so well, within a couple of weeks she was out of bed. In a month she was back in university, and she was totally always ringing me up. She got a first that year. And was about a year ago, yes, about a year ago now, I performed the marriage ceremony for her and her boyfriend. And then afterwards she did an exam, was thinking only about 6 people in about 1,000 were taken to this prestigious dentist course in Sydney. She got in. She's having a wonderful life, and she deserves it, because she's overcome her anxiety disorder with this very, 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 very simple mindfulness technique.
If ever you have fear or anxiety, you know that somewhere in your body there is a physical manifestation of that fear. Don't try and attack the emotion. You won't be able to do that. Find out the corresponding physical feeling. Massage that. Soften it. You can relax it. And when that's gone, so is the emotion. And I've been teaching that a long time now, because sometimes you may not have anxiety disorder, but sometimes you may have to go for an interview for a new job. You may be going to face the boss who's upset at you. It may be like young people, you're going to talk to a beautiful girl you want to invite out. Whatever it is, anxiety is part of our life. It may be you're just going to start a soccer match or something, or you've got some big test. Anxiety is just so common in our world, we don't know how to deal with it. And it's so easy to deal with it. The next time you are in a situation where you're very tense and afraid, an interview, a test, a big game, a big match in your life, whatever it is, where is the corresponding physical feeling? Notice that. Experience the feeling with as much mindfulness as you possibly can, and take your hand and massage it. And soon, when that physical feeling disappears, you'll find the emotion is gone as well. You can go into that interview, into that sports match, into that sort of talk to that beautiful guy or that beautiful girl you really like, and you have no fear at all, because all fear and anxiety has a physical manifestation. And you can attack the physical manifestation very easily. The mental thing is tough. So try that method. Very simple mindfulness technique, which works so effectively that you'll be able to overcome all your fears and be much more successful in your life. And that way the anxiety becomes a thing in the past, and you can face everything in life just without fear and do far better. The last story I'm going to tell before I open up for questions is another beautiful story. This is a story from the 2000 Olympic Games, which you may know were held in Australia, in Sydney. And in the Sydney Olympic Village in Homebush Bay, the New South Wales government, which were organising everything, arranged to have chaplains from all the major religions inside the village to give last minute prayers or spiritual support to all these athletes from around the world. And because Buddhism is a major religion, they had a Buddhist monk in the village. And he told this story, which was printed in the Sydney Morning Herald, that one day three people came to see him. There was the mother, father, and their daughter, the athlete, who was from Russia. They came to see him because she had just reached the final of the 800 meter sprint in the Olympic Games. In a couple of days' time, she'd be racing in front of the cameras of the world, not just her friends and family back home, in front of everybody. And she was so anxious, she wasn't sleeping, and she could hardly train. She never expected to do so well to make the final. And there she was. Now imagine that was you, how nervous you would be. This is Olympic Games final. Now even though they weren't Buddhists, everybody knows that the experts, the people who invented meditation, are the Buddhists. We invented it. So unfortunately, we never got the franchise, we never got the patent. So now everybody does it. Never mind, anyway, we don't mind, as long as it works. So the experts are the Buddhist monks. So they came to see the Buddhist monk to beg him to teach their daughter how to meditate, because they knew that would get rid of anxiety. So he gave them some very quick meditation advice, just like what I've done for you. And of course he didn't watch the TV, he didn't know what happened. They only came to see him for about 15 minutes, half an hour. But he said, 3 or 4 days later, he saw them walking towards him in the village. He could recognize them from a distance. There were three of them, the mother, the father, and the little athlete was in between. And the first thing you notice, they were smiling. So something good must have happened. The next thing you notice, as they came closer, he noticed that the athlete, this is how he put it, was swinging something on the end of a string. He didn't really know too much about medals until they came closer and he saw its colour, gold. She had won the gold medal in the 800 metres sprint in the 2000 Olympic Games, way exceeding her expectations, and they'd all come to thank the monk for teaching her how to overcome her anxiety through meditation. 2012 Olympic Games are going to be in London. Please contact your government and get somebody to teach your athletes how to meditate. And if they can overcome their nervousness and anxiety, who knows? Malaysia might win more gold medals in the 2012. But please, don't tell them that Ajahn Brahm suggested this. Otherwise Australia will be really upset. So that's actually how to overcome anxiety. It's very simple to do. And if you do that, you'll have a wonderful life. And anxiety will be a thing of the past. You can say goodbye to anxiety. So thank you for listening. That's the hour's talk. It went very quickly. So, now we do the questions. But first of all, from the floor, because last time I had so many questions on a piece of paper, didn't have enough questions from the floor. Does anyone want to ask a question about anxiety or fear from the floor? And don't be anxious about asking a question. Just massage something and then you'll be okay. Any questions about anxiety? There's an old saying I remember reading, that if you ask a question, and if you do ask a question, you might feel like you're a fool for asking the question. But if you don't ask the question, you'll feel a fool for the rest of your life. If you ask a question, just a fool for a moment. If you don't ask the question, you're a fool for the rest of your life. Any questions? Okay, I'm sure. Well, I'll let you think about that. I'll ask some. Yeah, you go on. Great. Yes. Go on.
Major religion also practices meditation. But why is it not encouraged?
Okay, it was because there are few religions now practice meditation. Because, you know, it's been in Buddhism from the very, very earliest times. If you look at Buddha statues, most of them are meditating, so it's an ancient tradition. However, that many religions have found out that meditation works so well, and it's so powerful, that it gives you like a great spiritual foundation for your life. It gives you wisdom, it gives you peace, it gives you compassion, and so many other religions are getting in on the act. So, and we don't mind that, because as long as it works, please. Many years ago, my book Opening the Door of Your Heart, when it was first published, I got a call from a pastor in South Australia, and he said, "You Ajahn Brahm?" I said, "Yes, I've just read your book, a fantastic book. Look, I'm going around converting people in South Australia. Would you mind if I use some of your stories?" And I said, "Of course, please do, because you're just making people wise and happy. So please do that." So I gave him permission. I don't mind that. As long as they're making people happier and wiser in this world. So like Buddhism started meditation, and so still we still got the edge, because, you know, we've got people who meditate full time, like myself. You know, the experts in meditation. So because of that we still have the edge. But other religions still do a little bit, but in the end they always come to us for the final advice. So, you know, we're like the specialists. They're the part-timers. But not everybody does that still. There's many religions, they're very strict. And you mention the word meditation and they think that must be Buddhism. So a lot of times we've actually asked people, if you're teaching meditation, don't call it meditation, call it something else like relaxation or mindfulness or quiet time. Exactly the same thing. When you call it quiet time, other religions don't get upset. And look, I don't care what religion you are, I just want people to be happy and peaceful and healthy. So if you want to sort of practice meditation, fine, don't call it meditation so you don't think it's Buddhism, because it works, it makes you happy and peaceful, gets rid of a lot of psychological problems. So please, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Hindu, Hindus do a lot of meditation, but please do it. And don't worry about its religious connotations, it shouldn't really upset anything. Does that answer your question, sort of? Okay, there's a question over in the middle first of all. Yes, lady? Oh no, the lady first of all. Ladies first. I'm a gentleman. That's a very good question there, that sometimes you have bad experiences of the past, and that bad experience is almost like a trauma in your mind, and it means when you get similar experiences you think the same consequences are going to happen again. And again, one of the greatest ways of overcoming that phobia is again a little bit of mindfulness, so you see that fear coming at the very earliest stage before it really grabs you. So in other words, you're in a similar situation and the fear hasn't really come up fully on yet, it's about to come up. So you catch it as early as possible. That's with mindfulness training, you can start to see the first bit of fear happening. And once that first bit of fear happens, then your wisdom, all these wonderful strategies, oh look, the chance of it happening again are really, really, you know, very, very light. I was in a plane crash once, but I survived. The chances of me being a plane crash twice are almost impossible. So you see the fear coming up, and if the fear is coming up right at the very beginning, it's very easy to deal with. Maybe some massage or some positive thinking, you know, using your rational mind or whatever. It's usually easy to overcome. The trick is catching it early. When a train is leaving the station, it's very easy to put the brakes on and stop when it's only just started. But once it's going along the tracks at a large number of kilometers per hour, it's very hard to stop a heavy train. And these emotions are like heavy trains. Catch them when they first start moving, and it's very easy to stop. So that's the first thing, catch them very early. So in other words, be on the lookout for those phobias, and then you can catch them. And number two, again, when those phobias do come up, if you try and get rid of them emotionally, the mind working on the mind, it does not work. Do something physical. Something physical, just, you know, like a massage or like having a cup of coffee or something which brings you in contact with your body and takes you away from the mind. Because the mind will just feed on itself like a feedback loop, and you get this terrible resonance, like sometimes you do if I hold this microphone close to the loudspeaker, you get the feedback. So if you try to stop it with mind to mind, you get feedback and it just goes out of control. So try and find something physical, feel that physical feeling and try and deal with that, so the phobia doesn't actually get too strong. Feel it on the body, not in the mind. Does that make any sense? No, it doesn't, obviously, for what you're talking. So say this, what can it be? Like, suppose that, you know, that somebody has been attacked. Maybe somebody's been mugged or something, walking down the street at night and someone's attacked you. This is just one possibility. It's not your case, but it should be similar enough. So somebody's really hurt you. And because you've been hurt once, because you don't want to be hurt again, you associate sort of that particular situation with that hurt. Sometimes you've got to somehow disassociate these new situations, because you may be walking down the same street, maybe the same time of night, but it's unlikely to happen again. You're making connections which aren't really rational. So the way to overcome that is when you're walking down that street at the same time of night, the same place, but you know, it's nothing is going to happen to you. Feel sensations in the body, calm those sensations down so you feel fear. Don't get in your head, is the message. Get into your body. And if you get into the body, you can calm the body down much easier. You can walk slowly is a good way of overcoming fear, because fear makes you do things very rapidly. Slow walking calms down the fear. A bit of sort of kindness or whatever, singing a happy song, whatever it is, sometimes that can overcome fear because it's physical. So that's one way of doing things. Eventually, you know, we all have to face those fears. We can't avoid you know, life. And just because you've been hurt once, please never put, as I put it, never put your heart in a concrete bunker. Yeah, it feels very safe in there, but it has no life. You have to take chances, and when you take those chances, you'll find you don't get hurt again. The alternative is like crawling deep inside of yourself. Yeah, it feels safe, but you have no life. Is that any better? Okay, a little bit better. Okay, the next question. Yeah, over there, yes.
You were talking about something attraction, when we refer to the law of attraction, when you focus something positively, you attract it. Right? How is the Buddhism interpret the law of attraction?
Oh, you're talking about the secret. It doesn't work. I mean, yeah, law of attraction up to a certain point. But if you start to think of the $1 million check in your post office box, have you been doing that? Hasn't worked for me. I haven't got $1 million yet. Now, sometimes positive thoughts has an effect. But it's other things also have an effect as well. You can't obviously have a law of attraction, think positive, 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 when you know you want to sort of what is it, to be the wealthiest person in Malaysia, and that goes too far. So in with limitations it does work. Now if you really want to be healthy and you think healthy thoughts, then yeah, you do attract good health. And if you're very fearful, you tend to do attract the objects which you fear. That is actually a truth. So I think the secret takes a truth of a law of attraction and just makes it very materialistic and over-exaggerates its power. But yeah, there is such a thing as a law of attraction, but in a much more moderate way than in that book. Does that really make sense and answer your question? Yeah?
I've used it.
You work? Are you a millionaire now? You're a millionaire? If you are, the donation box is on your way out. I'm visualizing your check going in the donation box. And the donation box is going to attract your check. Okay, very good. Next question? Okay, oh, at the back here. Oh, yeah. Sometimes you're so anxious that we dream about these things, we lose sleep, and many times I think you will probably know from your experience what you're really afraid of happening. It doesn't happen anyway. So please use your experience of life so far. All those things you've lost sleep on never happened. Like I said, that first dentist appointment, it never did happen anyway. So, number one, just check on your experience. It's not worthwhile worrying about things which are too uncertain and they probably won't happen anyway. And number two, again, the basic message over here is, I'm going to repeat what I've just said. If you start thinking about it and you say, I shouldn't think about it, it's almost impossible. I remember early on somebody, a psychologist, said to me, and I can prove this to you now. All of you close your eyes and please do not think of a white horse. And of course everyone thought of a white horse. That's how, just if you say I'm not going to feel afraid, you do feel afraid. It's the way the mind works. So if you try not feeling afraid, you just get more afraid. So trying to work on these things in the mind is just counterproductive. So what you do, you actually feel your body. There's a lot of people who have insomnia. And one of my friends over in Sydney, she's a Buddhist, a psychologist, and she started a company called sleeplikeababy.com on the internet. She's cleaned up, she's making a fortune. And she said to me that she has 100% success rate. People who follow her technique always have a good night's sleep, and they cure their insomnia without any pills. You know, all it is the Buddhist sweeping meditation. They start with the tip of your head, or I like prefer the toes. Feel the toes, any sensations in the toes, and relax them with kindness until your toes feel really relaxed. Then go to your feet, feel any sensations in your feet, and relax them. Take away all the tightness and tension in your feet. Then you go to your lower legs. Stage by stage, part by part, you sweep up the body, relaxing all of the muscles in your body as much as you can. And you, mindfulness starts to give you feedback. In other words, you notice sensations change and they move in the direction of relaxation. So much so that you actually are relaxing, say, your knees and your thighs. And if you do that, before you even get to your bottom, you'll be fast asleep. The reason is because you're taking your attention away from your mind and the fear. You're putting it in your body, you're relaxing, doing some compassion, some kindness, and soon you relax so much you're fast asleep. There's a very practical way, and you've heard it from me, so you saved a lot of money. And it works so well. Basic Buddhist mindfulness technique of the body, relaxing, and you go fully asleep. A lot of time, if you have insomnia for other reasons, in other words, you've had a very, very busy day, you've been doing so many things, one of the reasons you can't sleep is because the tension in your day is actually locked in your body. Actually, muscles are so tight, you know, that you can't relax enough to go to sleep. That is why that sometimes I do that method. If I've been working really, really hard and got to bed very late, sometimes I'm overtired, I can't really go to sleep. And so I don't go sweeping up my body and relaxing all these parts of my own body. And when I relax them, you go into a very, very nice deep sleep. So if you have insomnia, or you always find it difficult to sleep sometimes, you have like worries or fears, things go wrong, it's hard to go to sleep at night, try that sweeping meditation. Starting from your toes, relaxing everything stage by stage. And you only go to the next stage when that part feels as relaxed, as comfortable as you can possibly make it. You're taking all the tension of the day out of your body. And you go into a really nice sleep. So thank you for that question. Okay, let's do the paper questions now. Ajahn Brahm, my cousin got cancer. Her main worries are how her parents will take the news and her young sons if something happens to her. What is your advice for her? What would happen if nothing happened to her? In other words, if she survived. Used to these days, people who get cancers early, the survival rate is so great that most people actually survive cancers. So you say, I've got cancer, and main worries are how parents will take the news. Tell her, I've got cancer, the chances are I'm going to survive, so you're stuck with me for quite a few more years yet, mum. In other words, tell the truth, and instead of like people being afraid of cancer and thinking, oh my God, I've got cancer, that's terrible news, that's like a death sentence. No, they say over in Australia that cancer is a word, not a sentence. In other words, that most people survive cancers. The majority do. So if that's you, your chances are still very, very good. You're going to be here for a long time. And tell your young sons as well, the mummy's got cancer. It's like having a flu. It's like having these other diseases which are around. It's not the end of the world. It's not the end of your life. The chances are you're going to be here for a long time yet. So look at the truth of the matter, that cancer, most people with cancer usually get better. So don't be afraid. No, it's much better to keep things open, because they usually feel that something's wrong anyway. Your children are much smarter than you think. They know that mummy's worried about something.
So the sooner you tell them, the least they know you're being honest and you love them enough to share with them. And I think they'll be wise enough and adult enough, even though they may be young kids, to get some idea that mummy is sick, and they'll give you extra, extra love, which will also help you get better soon. Since praise is important for self-esteem, can we praise ourselves if we do something good? Yeah, please do so. So, every morning when you get up, the first thing I say to myself when I wake up in the morning, I've done this for years, I say, good morning me, have a great day. Try that tomorrow morning, don't go, oh God, 5 o'clock again. Say, good morning me, have a wonderful day. And the last thing I do before I go to bed at night, I say good night to me, have a great sleep, Ajahn Brahm. See you tomorrow morning. And that actually increases my self-esteem. And actually, I'm kind to myself. Who's the last person you see before you go to sleep at night? Yourself. So say good night. Who's the first person you see when you wake up? Here I am again, me. Have a great day. So praise is important. And if you do something nice, praise yourself. Receive praise, praise yourself. And if you do something wrong, what should you do? Throw it away. Don't keep the bad stuff. Only keep the good stuff. I don't know how many times I've told the story of the two chicken farmers. Have I told it in this retreat yet? Chicken farmers. Maybe this is one of the famous stories. Once there were two chicken farmers. The first chicken farmer went into the shed early in the morning to collect the produce from the night before. So he took the basket, went into the shed, and filled the basket full of chicken poo. You know, those little pellets of dung. And he left the eggs in the shed to rot. And he brought the chicken poo back into the house, where it stank the whole house out, and his family thought he was crazy. He was a very stupid chicken farmer. Chicken farmer number two took the basket into the shed. He left the chicken poo in the shed to rot. It will become valuable fertilizer later, but you don't bring it into the house with you. Instead, he put the eggs in the basket. And he brought the eggs back into the house where he could make an omelette for his family's breakfast and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That was a very smart chicken farmer. What's the meaning of that story? When you collect the produce of your past, everything you've done today and the days before, what do you put in your basket and bring home with you? Do you collect chicken poo? Or do you collect eggs? Most of you are chicken poo collectors. You collect the stinky stuff of life, all the stuff which went wrong, and all the beautiful events of life you let rot in the past. You never carry them with you. Any nice things you've done, you forget. All your mistakes, you keep. You're a dumb chicken farmer. Understanding that story means all the wonderful things which you have achieved today, take that into your present and future with you. All the mistakes, all the silly things, the bad things you've done, let that rot in the past. And if you think that is a very bad way of living life, if you think that you will learn from your mistakes, no, you don't. You learn from successes much better than you learn from mistakes. I've taught this to businesses, in conferences where there's been many, many chief executives. And I've told them, look, if you start dwelling on the mistakes in your company, what went wrong, number one, your morale goes down. You lose your energy. You lose your inspiration, and you waste a lot of time thinking about what went wrong. Instead, If you focus on what went right, the successes this year. Number one, it encourages you. It lifts up morale as everyone realizes, yeah, we were successful. And number two, you learn why it was successful. So you can repeat the causes which worked last time. And then you get more success. You learn from successes much more than you learn from mistakes. So if you remember all your successes by praising yourself, you will increase your success rate. Not the other way around. You keep focusing on your mistakes and you make more mistakes. Understand? So praise and don't blame. Next question. Wow, they're coming fast. I better be quick. Ajahn, please could you advise on how one could help a very troubled young man with self-doubt? I'm being too quick. Please could you advise on how one can help a very troubled young man with self-destructive behaviours and is also fighting a battle against opiate addiction? He is now 21 years of age. He is doubly handicapped by high intelligence and ADHD, with his social and emotional development delayed, lagging far behind his intellect. This young man has a privileged upbringing with undemanding and uncontrolling parents who do not even expect the brilliant academic achievements he has attained with minimal effort due to his high intelligence. This young man has continuous support from his parents, who have shown him unconditional love despite the difficult challenges since his teens. They have sought advice from psychiatrists and psychologists with no avail. As he is highly intelligent, he is also not an easy patient for any psychiatrist or psychologist. This young man remains a very depressed, highly anxious, easily frustrated and angry young man. His parents do not know what to do except to show their love and provide encouragement and moral support. On another note, you're an incredibly extraordinary person. Thank you for all the very inspiring talks you have given. Yes, I deserve that. That was from the first talk. Yeah, I think if he is very, very intelligent, he's obviously academically intelligent but emotionally stupid. Remember that sort of great book, The Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, another Buddhist. Sometimes the real intelligence has nothing to do with your academic achievements, because I too know a friend who went to Cambridge with me to study medicine, and he too became a heroin addict. He destroyed his whole career. And the last time I met him, about 4 or 5 years ago, he was making a living mowing gardens as a gardener. So the poor fellow, he ruined a brilliant career. Again, intelligent academically, but emotionally unintelligent. So in order for this young man to get some emotional intelligence, if he's really academically intelligent, challenge him with meditation would do really well for a guy like that. The ADHD will respond very well to some mindfulness meditation. But he needs obviously to be motivated to be able to do that. Maybe if he is at intelligence, maybe challenge his intelligence by seeing if he can actually do some Buddhist meditation. See if he can do that. So that's one possibility. And the other possibility, if he's 21 years of age, is finding him a girlfriend. Because girls have a lot of power over boys. And no matter how intelligent he feels, his hormones will take control. And the girl can actually change his behavior enormously. I always remember this, one of my sort of disciples over in Perth, he's a Malaysian guy, and his son had a girlfriend, but his grades at university were getting worse and worse and worse as he wasn't doing the work. And he told his son, look, you better sort of not spend so much time going out with your girlfriend and stay home and do the assignments. You know, your grades are going down. But he wouldn't listen to his father. But his father was very smart. So what he did, he waited until he came home with his girlfriend. And he was waiting about 1 o'clock in the morning. And he's standing in front of the door and he said to the girlfriend and the boy, both of you come in. And the boy was embarrassed and the girl was very scared. What's going on? And he sat them down and gave them a sort of a cup of tea. And he never even looked at his son. He addressed the girlfriend and said to the girlfriend, he said, now look, you've been going around out with my son for quite a long time now. I don't know exactly the state of your relationship, but you know, who knows, it may turn out to be something even more serious and deep. You know, one day you may even get married. I just wanted to tell you, girlfriend, that his grades are going down so badly that he may not finish university. Do you want to marry a person who doesn't do university? I said, no! Of course I don't want to marry a stupid boy. I never knew his grades were going down. He never told me that. Well, I thought I should let you know. And from that day on, she always made sure he got home early and he had to do his assignments before she would even go out with him. She had so much power over him, much more so than his father. So he actually finished his university, did very well, and they got married. So girls have a lot of power over boys, and so just use whatever leverage you can find. I'll put this on the floor. Can Ajahn Brahm please explain the difference between Theravada, Mahayana and Vajrayana? I'm very new to Buddhism. Okay. It's all the same cake with different icing. Theravada we have brown icing. Mahayana they usually have grey icing. And Vajrayana has like this maroon, crimson icing. If you go underneath, all the same. Or Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, it's all Buddhism. So that on the surface they may do different ceremonies. And they may just have on the surface different teachings. But you dig deep and it gets to be the same, which is a beautiful thing. That's why monks from all the traditions, we get on so well. Because we understand the deeper teachings. The ceremonials, you may think my ceremonies is more effective than somebody else's ceremony. That's just ceremonies, that's rituals, that's superficial. Underneath, we meditate, we've got the same mind, works the same way. Enlightenment is the same thing. There was only one Buddha. Was the Buddha Theravada, Mahayana or Vajrayana? It was just a Buddha. So, because of that, I decided to try and unite them in a new Yana. So, the other word for Theravada is Hinayana. So the three Yanas were Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. So, let's take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana and the Yana from Vajrayana, and what do we get? Hahayana. And that's my vehicle. So I follow the Hahayana. Having depression for the last 10 years, you join Hahayana, you get no depression. Having depression for the last 10 years with 3 times relapses and on medication for the last 5 years, I'm looking for ways to help myself to come out of depression, not wanting to rely on medication. How can I seek help by way of Buddhism? Easy. Well, you come to these talks, you laugh a lot, and when you laugh a lot, your depression totally disappears. For a while anyway, you get positive attitudes towards life, you think of all the wonderful things which happen to you in life, and then depression disappears. And number 2, or number 3, I can't count, number 3, you are not always depressed. You're not a depressed person. You're a person who sometimes suffers from depressed moments. Please remember that. Because I went to give a keynote speech at, I think it was about the 50th or 60th, 80th or whatever anniversary of the Singapore Institute of Mental Health. You know, the old Woodlands Hospital. And they were inviting me to give a speech, and I gave a speech. And they were so impressed that one of the doctors took me to his ward. And he said, look, I'm a Christian, but I want you to bless my ward. I thought that was quite sweet. And as I was talking to him, what is your ward? It was a schizophrenia ward. And I asked him, how do you treat schizophrenia? And his answer was, it's just like you said in your talk, Ajahn Brahm, we don't treat schizophrenia in my unit. We treat the other part of the patient. We treat the part that's not schizophrenic. And I looked at him and said, thank goodness that someone's understood. Because if you treat the schizophrenia, you're telling that person is a schizophrenic. They become a schizophrenic. They act like a schizophrenic. They identify as being schizophrenic. And there's hardly any way forward. You treat the other part of them. And they recognize it's a huge part of them which is not schizophrenic at all.
schizophrenia is only episodes which come from time to time. When they notice the other part of them, their self-esteem rises, their confidence rises, and they find that those times when they're not schizophrenic extend and grow so much that they squash out of existence the schizophrenic episodes. This is state-of-the-art treatment for schizophrenia. I've known this a long time. This is the way the mind works. I used this when I was teaching in prisons. I've been in many prisons teaching. I've never yet seen a criminal in prisons. All I've ever seen is a person who's done a crime, but never a criminal. Understand? There's never no such thing as an adulterer. It's a person who's committed adultery. Understand? There's no such thing as a terrorist. There's a person who's done terrorist acts. There's no such thing as a schizophrenic. There's a person who experiences schizophrenia from time to time. When you understand that, you understand the way out of crime, out of terrorism, out of schizophrenia. Also, you understand the way out of depression. You're more than the two bad bricks in the wall. Look at the 998 good bricks, focus on that, and much of your depression is gone. If that doesn't work, just do some meditation. Again, that's the British National Health Service preferred therapy for depression. So you come to the right place. Your lucky day. A bit of good. What about Japanese Buddhism? Chanting Nammo Orenki, something or other. Can one chant that Japanese version, plus also Mahayana, Tibetan? Is there any contradiction? Doesn't matter what you chant. It's actually the very fact if you keep chanting it, it keeps you focused. You don't think of other negative things. And if the chant has a meaning for you, it's very inspiring, then it works. But if you don't know what the heck you're chanting, if it's all gobbledygook for you, then of course it doesn't have much power. So if I was you, I'd choose something which is really inspires you. Any phrase which really makes you feel inspired, impressed, and in your own language. You don't have to do it in Japanese or in Pali or Sanskrit or in Swahili. Do it in your own language, something which when you say it really inspires you and resonates with you. That's why if you want to do metta meditation, may all beings be at peace and free from suffering. But when you do the chant, listen once the words are finished, so you can understand the meaning. May all beings be at peace and free from suffering. Because words have a meaning. And if we don't stop to listen to the meaning once the words are finished, the words are useless. May all beings be at peace and free from suffering. It's beautiful. And that's how we could do some chanting. A nice simple word. Make it up for yourself and listen afterwards. And then it has a great power. Isn't all Buddhism the same? Why so many types? Yeah, I know, but why are there so many types of cars, even though they've got the same engines inside? It's just marketing, that's all. How many types of yogurt can you buy in the supermarket these days? Yeah, I mean, it's yogurt made in France, yogurt made in Australia, yogurt from Malaysia, and yogurt with strawberries in, yogurt with, I don't know what else you got yogurt in, but it's all yogurt, isn't it? So just like Buddhism. Can one practice a mixture of Mahayana, a little Tibetan, Vajrayana, and Taoism together? Yeah, of course you can. You know, like just today, I had some spaghetti, and I had some of those little balls, you know, the Chinese thing you've got to have. I didn't want to eat them because people said if you eat them you're 1 year older. I'm already old enough. So I had Italian food, I also had some fish and chips, so I had English food. So I had many, many different nationalities of food today. So there's nothing wrong with that. So that way that you can practice a little bit of Mahayana, Tibetan, Vajrayana, Taoism together, whatever you want. Mix it all up. Then you're one of the modern people who have all sorts of different cuisine. If one is also a Taoist practitioner with a little bit of Buddhism, is it okay to burn
paraphernalia to our ancestors, they are our loved ones, and not everyone can go to heaven. Oh, it's a waste of time burning all that paper. Come on, be rational. Sort of, you know, is that going to actually reach heaven? All they're going to get in heaven is a lot of ashes. It doesn't work that way. So the best thing to do, instead of burning all that paper, why not spend the money sponsoring a Dharma book?
Sponsor
what?
My MP3
or a Dharma book, whatever it is, because then actually the paper is actually read by people and it inspires so many people, and then you can share the merits of sponsoring a Dharma book or an MP3 with your departed relations, and that has far better effect than burning all this paraphernalia. So if you really want to use paper as a way to get merit for your departed ones, sponsor books. Because some of those books, like even my book, the effect that has had, it's over 22 languages now. The latest one is Bulgarian, that book. I got the Lithuanian copy the other day. Somebody sent me an author's free copy of Lithuanian. Don't understand a word of it.
But that's actually saved many people's lives. So if you sponsor a book like that, you're actually saving lives. I'm telling you, what's not happened, there's a piece as well. So that means when you sponsor a really good book, wow, that's amazing. That really is heavy merit. Really heavy good karma. And then once you've made a lot of good karma, then you can share it with your departments. Okay, this is a meditation question. I'm going to put the meditation questions on until tomorrow. Okay, this is... that's another meditation question. Basically, Ajahn Brahm, I would like to be a nun. Oh, this is a man. It's really weird people in these days. I don't know how much better this is ever in medicine. Oh, sorry. I would like to be a monk. However, I heard that being a nun is more difficult than a monk, as the lay people are meant to be more supportive than the monks. Now, that is a terrible thing. All you Buddhists, sometimes we give lots of requisites to the monks. Look at the beautiful temples we live in, the monks. What about the nuns? There's one over there. How many of you have offered dana or angpao to the nun? So, please do so. So that, you know, the nuns can also be supported. And your women, you know, most of the people who come to the temple are women. Well, no, there's most of them over here. So you should be supporting women. Look after them, please. And all you men, if you feel guilty that you haven't been kind to women, you support her too. It is true that it's really important to have that with both parts of the Sangha. In the time of the Buddha, there were monks and nuns. And some of those nuns were great teachers, and we try to make sure we have that again in our modern world. It's hard enough to get monk teachers in Malaysia, isn't it? So imagine if we have nuns as well. In Mahayana, then you really look up to them and say that they have got lots and lots of great Buddhist nuns, as well as monks. So if you like Theravada, we have to do catch up in Theravada, so that we also have great nuns as well. So that when a woman wants to become a monastic, that she can choose her tradition, Theravada she wants to be, and all the resources again. And you all have been working very hard to try and make that happen in Australia. While meditating, a vision of a nun sitting in an upright meditation pose appeared. It lasted only for 1 or 2 seconds. I just noted on that and carried on focusing on my breath. What should I do at this stage? That must be an omen. That's a sign. That will be you. No, yeah, it'd be great. So it could be that you've got some affinity there with that type of monastic tradition. Here we go. That's a meditation question. Could do a meditation question tomorrow. Meditation question. Meditation question. Meditation question. Okay, here we go. This is a good one. In your experience, how do the people of other religions are welcoming the meditation, especially the Muslims? And how is it like in Australia? Are people warm to the idea of meditation? Are
course, down here in Australia, people love meditation. They just get so many invitations to teach meditation, you can't just keep up with them all. Because the science is there. Everybody knows it works. Even in schools. I think there was a school in England, I think it was Wellington School, I think, first of all, introduced meditation as a compulsory subject for every student in that public school. When the press heard about this, they interviewed the principal, "Are you a Buddhist?" He said, "No." "Are you trying to make these students Buddhists?" "No." "Well, why are you teaching meditation?" "Because I know it's been proven it increases the grades and the academic performance of all the children." That's the only reason why. People know that. If your kids do meditation, the grades go up. So those people who are here, if you want your kids to learn at school, teach your kids meditation, they do far better. The young kids, you come and do meditation. It means you don't have to do so much homework and you still get good grades. And as for people, other religions are welcoming the meditation, especially the Muslims. In countries like Indonesia, I go to Indonesia a lot, and you get some, it's a more liberal country there, the Muslims in Indonesia, they come to my talks, they have photographs together, they learn meditation, they love it. There's no reason why they can't meditate. There's nothing which is really against their religion about doing meditation. Making the mind peaceful and calm and giving themselves a lot of happiness and insight, there's nothing wrong with that at all. So yeah, in Australia there's no problem at all. If a person is scared, afraid of another person, there's no reason. Is it possible it's being brought them from the past life? Yes, that person may have murdered you in the last life, or may have stolen from you in the last life. It's very unlikely. So if you're really afraid of another person, sometimes it could be just, you know, some reason why that they remind you of probably something which happened to you in this life rather than the past life. It is possible, but it's very, very unlikely. Anyway, it's a new life, a new person, they're not the same, they do change, they don't really have to be afraid of them. So give them some love and kindness, and then you won't be afraid of them. Can hypnosis help solve the anxiety by enabling the person to look at the past life? Yeah, that can do. There is a story. Our president of our Buddhist society in Perth, he's an amateur hypnotist, and he regresses people to their past lives. And he told me this great story from a conference he went to in Sydney last year. That one of his fellow hypnotists who regresses people to their past lives had this case of a young girl, you know, from New South Wales in Australia, who was anorexic. So she just would not eat. She was maybe about 18 years of age or 17 years of age. And her anorexia was so bad that the doctors and psychologists were not having any effect. She was getting thinner and thinner, weaker and weaker, and the mother was so afraid she was going to die. As a last resort, she took her to this hypnotherapist who would try and regress her to her previous life, thinking that maybe they'd find the cause of the anorexia and be able to heal it. And as it happened, the girl was very easy to hypnotize. And she got into her past life. So this happened in the doctor's, the hypnotist rooms, and the mother was there, just the three of them. You know, the doctor, the mother, and the girl being hypnotized. And when she went into her previous life, she recounted that she was the younger of two sisters, and they had both fallen in love with the same guy. Her elder sister was attractive. She was plain. Boys being boys, the boy fell in love with the older sister, and they got engaged. And the younger sister was so heartbroken that she lost the love of her life, that she committed suicide. She killed herself. And in this life she was reborn as this girl, and she was trying so desperate to be beautiful by starving her body, because her vain looks had caused her so much suffering. And she had to commit suicide in her previous life. That was the cause of her anorexia. But the fascinating part of that story is when she recounted the cause of her anorexia in this life, the heartbreak of not being beautiful in her previous life, the mother was sobbing hysterically. And when the hypnotist calmed the mother down, the mother said, I was her sister. That was my younger sister early on in my life. I never told my daughter this. Before she was born, I had a young sister. We fell in love with the same guy. My younger sister killed herself. Now she's being born as my daughter. It all fell into place. That's how our karma works so closely together. She got reborn as a daughter because that's the closest she could get to the man she loved. She could not marry him in the previous life, but now she could be the man's daughter. Fascinating, that's how karma works out. So yeah, repression can actually uncover a lot of the reasons why these things happen. Interesting.
Sorry?
You've got to let go before you die. You've got to let go, yeah, but they weren't Buddhist before. The reason was that me and my friends hadn't come there yet. So it's my fault that I got what's really hurt. In doing mental meditation, as a... Okay, that's another meditation question. Okay. Ajahn Brahm, you were saying meditation is good for controlling anxiety or depression, but how does one know if one does meditation mindfulness correctly? It's because anxiety and depression disappear. That's a circular argument. What is meditation, by the way? Okay, what meditation is relaxing the mind. That's just an easy way of putting it, because you all know how to relax the body. You go home, sit in a nice chair, have a cup of tea, and just switch on your favorite movie or music, and you just relax. You see how relaxing now, just the body gets all relaxed. You're holding nothing tight. Everything is nice and loose. And that's how you meditate. You hold nothing tight. No cravings, no ill wills. Your whole mind gets very, very loose, peaceful, relaxed, and then happy, and then still. That's how you meditate. Some people meditate like this type. They never know what meditation is. And depression and anxiety get worse. They meditate like that. So meditate, really relax. Loose, easy, peaceful, kind. In breathe, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's the essence of meditation. If you do that, you make peace with things. Anxiety, depression just don't come. Are you kind? It just can't exist. If you're very gentle, it doesn't happen. So this is actually how we do things. One of the other reasons why there's depression, an increase in depression, is because in our modern world we have to compete so fiercely. We have to put so much effort into our lives. The amount of effort we put in is directly proportional to the amount of depression in our societies. In previous years, previous decades, life was much slower, more easier, with more time just to relax. We didn't have so much depression. Because we control so much, we fight so hard, we struggle just so much. The consequence of that is depression. We get tired, we get frustrated, and after a while, we give up. Giving up big time is called depression. Just can't even get out of bed. All coming from how much we fight, how much we struggle, and how we don't know how to really relax and take life easy. Don't think that taking life easy means you won't succeed in it. Having time where you rest and recuperate makes your mind sharper and more effective when you go to work. Dell Computing, the United States, one of the top 50 companies in the world, has a time-out room in their headquarters where any person working in that organization can go into the time-out room, meditate, relax, just hang loose, however long they want. In that room, it is screened, so you cannot get any mobile calls, SMSs, or texts at all. It's a time for total relaxation. And the company does that because it knows when people spend 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour in the timeout room, when they go back to work, then they are sharp, they don't make mistakes, they don't spend time arguing with other people in their office. Everything increases in productivity because they're more efficient. And I've told a lot of kids this who are studying at university. If you're looking in front of that computer screen, finishing the assignment, there comes a time when your brain is stuffed. You can't really work well. You're staring and not being productive at all. It's not an efficient way to use your brain. Stop. Turn off the computer. Relax. Rest. Listen to some music or whatever. And go back to the computer later. And then your mind is clear, precise, and you can perform. You can achieve. But unfortunately, many people, they just keep pushing their mind when really the best thing to do would be to relax and rest. So when we learn meditation, we actually become far more productive and efficient at university, at business, and in life. That's why the corporations like teaching meditation. It increases their productivity. So meditation is good for controlling anxiety and depression. How to practice meditation? I've designed many types of meditation. Which type is good for depression? The very soft, kind, gentle ones are good for depression, because they eventually give you lots of good energy. So come here, and you can learn lots of meditation. Your talks are wonderful and inspired. Yeah, I agree with that. Pace yourself. In Buddhism, always emphasize on compassion, but some stories that you share with us are very painful life experiences of a person. I wondered if it's compassion to share in public since he or she shared with you. Does this affect that person's emotions? Concern. Now, most of the people who tell me their personal stories, I never actually say who it is, so they don't know, but they're very happy actually to share, because usually the ones who tell me their stories, they're helped and they get much better, and they're very happy to share their path, how they got out of suffering into a beautiful life. That lady who had that panic disorder in Adelaide, she's really happy that I shared her story, because it had such a beautiful, happy ending. She still keeps in touch, and she was so impressed with me that she actually nominated me for Australian of the Year. Because I just saved her life and brought her so much happiness, so there's nothing she wouldn't do for me right now. And she loves sharing that story because it's inspiring. The person who's bedridden was on the end of her life, depressed, anxious, and now she's having a beautiful life. So they're very, very happy that we share stories. And also means it makes things real. So it's not just theory, this is real life, real people, and that could be you. Actually, my colleague is depressed and keeps complaining and accusing people around. He's not a Buddhist. Why should I talk to him to make him feel better while he's being defensive? So his mind is looping on negative perspectives. Again, if you tell him he's wrong to be negative, he just gets more negative. So the only thing he is touching to use negative psychology. And say, I'm really impressed how depressed you are. I'm the most negative person. Thank you for being so negative. But this is one thing which I did when I was a school teacher. It's an old story, but there was a boy in my class. I think I told this one of the first nights. A boy in my class who came 30th, bottom of the class. And I had to give out the report cards as a teacher class. It was in a high school. 30th in a class of 30. And when he got his report card, the soldier was bottom of the class. His jaw dropped, and you could see by his expression, he was depressed. And he was also afraid he would have to take that report card to his father that night and be in big trouble. And of course, I'm a compassionate monk, and so if I see anyone depressed, I would try and help them, but I possibly could. So I went up to him, and I said, you come bottom. He said, yes, sir, sorry. No, sorry. It's a wonderful thing you've done, and I'm going to teach you some Buddhism. They already are Buddhist. And I said to this kid, I said, in Buddhism we have something called the Bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is someone who sacrifices their own happiness for the sake of all other beings. You have sacrificed yourself this year. So no one else has to take this terrible position of being 30. No other kid in the class has to face their father that's not like you do. You are so compassionate that you deliberately took on this position on purpose, with the compassion in your heart to save other people from that terrible suffering of becoming 30. But you are this year's bodhisattva, and I award you the bodhisattva medal. And he looked at me as if I was crazy. But he laughed. And his depression ended. And next year it was someone else's chance to win the bodhisattva medal for bottom of the class. You don't have to be selfish and come top. So the ones who sacrifice themselves come bottom. So no one else has to take that suffering. I take the suffering for you, classmates. So that was actually a good thing I did. Okay, questions. Here we go, a philosophical one. Whatever one believes and conceives, one can achieve. How true is this statement? If you believe that the Malaysia football team is going to win the World Cup, you are not to answer my question. So, okay, some beliefs are conceived that within the realms of possibilities, but some are totally impossible. So keep it real. And number two is a part of harmonious wealth encouraged by Buddhist philosophy. For lay persons, of course it is. Because if you want to be wealthy, you shouldn't spend so much. So you simply, just like me, just one pair of clothes, just a little bag, just simple food, and a small house. If you have small, simple things, you don't spend so much. Where does your money go? But just into the bank, you become wealthy. So that's a big, that's my secret of wealth. Work hard, spend little.
Didn't want to do that, did they?
So no, that's actually material wealth. What is real wealth? There was a story of the Mexican fisherman. One of my favorite ones. It's the last story before I let you go. So one day there was an American professor on vacation on the coast of Mexico. And he was watching this fishing boat come in just before lunch. And he watched this fisherman unload his catch, tie up his boat, and then walk away. And the professor just wanted a bit of a conversation, so he asked the fisherman, he said, "What are you doing?" And the fisherman said, "I've been out all morning catching fish, senor. I've caught enough fish, you know, to feed myself and my family, and enough to just to pay the bills. Now I'm going to go and have lunch with my wife and my kids. After lunch I'll have a siesta. And in the afternoon I'll be at home to play with my kids when they come back from school. And the evening after dinner with my wife, which I have every evening with her, then I'll go to the cantina to play a guitar and just have a little few beers, just for fun. Life is good." And the professor said, "Sir, you're being lazy." He said, "I am a professor of business studies from a prestigious American university. That's why I'm on vacation. I can help you with some free advice. Yeah, go home for lunch. But in the afternoon, take your boat out in the afternoon. You're wasting resources. Take your boat out in the afternoon, you'll be able to catch twice as many fish, which means twice the profit. When you save up that money, you'll soon be able to buy a much bigger boat with a crew this time. With a bigger boat and a crew, you'll be able to catch four or five times as many fish every day. And soon, with the profits you get from that, in 3 or 4 years, you'll be able to buy another boat. In about 10 years, you'll have a whole fleet of boats. When you have a whole fleet of boats, and there's a person who owns a whole fleet, you'll be able to move your headquarters to Mexico City, or even better, to, say, Los Angeles. And then you'll be able to float your company on the stock market, and being the CEO, you'll be able to award yourself stock options, and thereby, in a few years, you'll be a multi-millionaire. That's actually how we do things. You can just be rich, really rich, a millionaire. And the prisoner was listening to all this, and then asked the question, "But Signor, what will I do next when I'm a millionaire?" And the professor never thought that far. He just thought about being a millionaire and what to do next. So the professor had to think on his feet and said, "Yeah, well, once you're a multi-millionaire, then you can retire. Yeah, you can retire. You can retire to a nice fishing village like this. You can find yourself a little boat just to go around in the morning. You'll be able to have lunch with your family every day, a siesta after that. You'll be there every evening when your kid comes home from school and you have no way to go to the pub in the evening to play some guitar." But Signor, I did that already. Why do people want to be wealthy so that they can live like 40 and have lots and lots of time? What is wealth? Wealth is having time.